Open up to Genesis chapter 12. We're going to be reading verses 10 through 20 to get started today. As we come to these verses, God has called Abram, not yet Abraham, and Sarai, in from Ur of the Chaldees, a lush, fertile valley, into the land of promise, into the desert land that he will give to all of the descendants in time of Abraham. And so when we pick up in verse 10, Abraham has arrived in that land. He's been there. We really aren't given a time frame, but for a while, my guess is that he sojourned, moved around for a while as God pointed out the land to him. But during that period of time, however long that was, a famine came into the land that was promised Abraham, and we pick up where he has decided to take his and move into Egypt to weather out the famine. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And it came to pass when he was come near to enter into Egypt that he said unto Sarai his wife, "Behold, now I know that you are a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass when the Egyptians shall see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will save you alive. Say, I pray you, that you are my sister, that I may be well with, that it may be well with me for your sake, and my soul shall live because of you." And it came to pass that when Abram was come into Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he entreated Abram well for her sake. And he had sheep and oxen and asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this that you have done unto me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so I might have taken her to me to wife? So I might have taken her to me to wife. Now therefore, behold, thy wife, take her and go your way." And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that he had. So Sarah is what we would call, in today's parlance, a babe. And Abram is letting her know that when they get there, they're going to see you, and they're going to say she deserves to be in Pharaoh's house. This wasn't an issue in the wilderness, because for the most part, those were tribal lands. People traveled in groups, but in Egypt, there was a pharaoh. In Egypt, there was a king and a kingdom. And that was a whole different situation. Abram could have defended his wife and this stuff against any of the other sheikhs in the land, but not against the power of Egypt. Now, most people would refer to what Abraham did here as a white lie, because Sarah was, in fact, Abraham's half-sister. So he wasn't necessarily completely lying, except for the fact that she was first and foremost his whole wife. He wasn't with her as a sister, he was with her as a wife. But fear over the possibility, let me point that out, that he could lose his life moved Abram to lie to Pharaoh and to make Sarah his accomplice, placing her in moral jeopardy over a possibility, not a certainty. Now, I say that, and we're going to back up in the same chapter just to verses 1 through 3. I say that he is doing this in the light of what God has already said to him before he was shipped off into the wilderness. Let's read 1 through 3 in the same chapter. "Now the Lord had said unto Abram, 'Get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curse you. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed.'" This is the first time really that that was fulfilled, in the sense that Pharaoh took Sarah and God cursed him. Exactly what he said he would do right back here. He's already said to Abram, "I'm going to make of you a great nation." That hasn't happened yet. And it's certainly not going to happen to a childless couple in the middle of nowhere if Abraham dies. He's already been promised by God that he's going to become a great nation, and yet what does he do? He fears that he'll lose his life which means he's listening to a different scenario than the one that God has said to him, and he's acting out of fear. King David, out of fear that his dalliance and the pregnancy of Bathsheba would be discovered, first tried to con Uriah, her husband, into thinking that her pregnancy was due to his leave from battle. And when that failed, he simply sent Uriah on a mission that he could not and did not survive. Fear creates and then believes its own future outcome, its own scenario. Fear is the opposite and the enemy of faith. When we act on fear, when we act on what might be, not what already is, we will lie, whether it's that white lie or a bigger lie. We will withhold information. It might not say, well, that's not really lying. We're just not telling them that the starter is getting ready to go out of the car, even though we know it's getting ready to go out of the car. We'll use deception, we'll plot, just to hang on to some money that flies out the window at the slightest provocation, to keep our job, to protect our reputation, to save our marriage, or to think that we are. Fear causes us to think that we have no other choice. Somehow we start to believe that the truth would cause us to lose what we actually need to keep. I'm working on this message this week, and I noticed a couple of television shows, and I'm noticing it's become a staple among some of the more dramatic shows, that one of the main characters is threatened with the kidnapping of their wife or their family or the death of their family, and so they betray their country. And a number of people die, or they steal money at the bank, or they do something horrible with the prospect that I need to save my family. Now, they've allowed somebody else's family to be killed, and I guess that's okay. And that's what they're using it for, is to say, listen, if it looks like it's going to turn out really bad, it's okay if we do stuff that's really bad in lieu of what might occur. It's a lie. One that we should not and cannot follow. In reality, it's destroying what we're trying to keep. Even in the TV shows, it never works out the way they want it to. Very few people are willing to do what's right in spite of the possible outcome, in spite of what happened. What if I do lose my job? Is that the very worst thing that could happen to me, that I lose my job? Might the Lord instead have a better job for me? Few will stay anchored to the truth without distortion, whatever the end comes from that. Few. Psalm 56:3 says, when I am afraid, I will put my trust in you, because it's exactly when we are afraid that we are most likely to not trust the Lord. We are attempting to control what we have no power to control, which is the outcome of our life. Boaz will not let the fear of what might be possible determine his actions. And so he will, in the end, discover God's will on the matter. Let's go to Ruth chapter 4. We are closing down. I think this is the fastest I've ever made it through a book. It's a record, one I don't plan on keeping up. Verses 1 through 6. Then went Boaz up to the gate and sat him down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, unto whom he said, ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. I like that. Ho! That's pretty cool. I might start using that. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit you down here. And they sat down, and he said unto the kinsman, Naomi, that's come again out of the country of Moab, sells a parcel of land which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise to you, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. And if you'll not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it besides you, and I am after you. And he said, I'll redeem it. Then said Boaz, what day you buy the field of the hand of Naomi, you must buy it also of Ruth. Hang on, lost my focus there. Then said Boaz, what day you buy the field of the hand of Naomi, you must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. And the kinsman said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem you my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it. Now, Boaz, and here's the way the scenario starts. Boaz, or Naomi, wants Boaz to marry Ruth. No question. Ruth wants Boaz to marry Ruth. And Boaz wants Boaz to marry Ruth. Boaz has the ability, has the financial ability to do so. He has all of the qualifications of a kinsman redeemer. However, he is not the first in line to accept the honor. He is second. Could not God have simply made Boaz first? Wouldn't it have been simple? Naomi makes her Ruth go and see him, and he says, yeah, I'm in. I'll see you tomorrow. We'll get married. Everything will be fine. I'll redeem the land, and we'll take care of it legally, and everything will be done. But no, God makes him second in line. There is an obstacle to achieving the end that the three desire. An obstacle Boaz will face with faith and not fear. There will be no lies perpetrated, no threats, no plots, no deceptions. Boaz will example a wise and godly way to face an obstacle. And when all is said and done, there will be no doubt as to what God intends in this scenario. He will begin to discover that end, to discover how the matter will fall. It says, in the gate. He comes to the gate. Now, the gate refers to the main gate of the city of Bethlehem. Towns were walled for protection, and there was generally several gates, but there was the gate, and that was the main gate of the city. It opened up into a very large town square. It was the civic center of the town, the marketplace, and the court where the elders sit. In fact, when you walked into the gates, the very first thing on both sides of those gate walls, on the inside were benches that were lined up against the wall, and in front of it where the elders would sit. They would come each day, or if they were called and they knew there was an issue, then they would come and sit in the gate, and they would adjudicate whatever decisions came their way. And the people in the town in the open gate area could, just like in a courtroom today, you can go in and sit down or stand and listen to the proceedings. You can listen in on what's going on. They weren't private. All legal issues were adjudicated there. Family matters, civil matters, and even criminal matters. Levirate laws were considered family matters. So this morning at that gate, it was family court that was in session. Family matters were worked out between parties at the gate. So the elders or the magistrates would come and sit, and the family matter was talked out between the two parties until they arrived at a conclusion. And if that conclusion was legal and right, that the elders could sign off on it, they would do so. And after that, it was a legally binding issue. There were no smoke-filled back rooms, no secret negotiations, no redacted documents, no national security or plausible deniability allowed. Paul in 2 Corinthians 13:1 says that witnesses exist to establish the truth. All we do is leak documents nowadays out of context and for our own ends. The witnesses were there to establish every word that was said in its context. You imagine what would change in this country if that was happening in our nation's capital? This is very critical, especially when we consider the words of Jesus in Luke chapter 12. Turn to Luke 12. Luke 12, verses 1 through 3. In the meantime, when there were gathered together an innumerable multitude of people, insomuch that they trod one upon another, so there was a large crowd there pressing on each other, the Lord began to say unto his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Then listen to this. For there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, neither hid that shall not be known. Therefore, whatsoever you have spoken in the darkness shall be heard in the light, And that which ye have spoken in the ear in closets shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. We can lie through our teeth right now and feign that we are getting away with it. That nobody knows what's going on in that back room, in that dark place. But there is coming a time when every word that we speak will stand in judgment. We should remind ourselves of these truths before we speak every single time. Before we decide to choose fear over faith. Because that is composed of lies and deceptions and plots and threats and withheld information. Listen, some matters rightly require privacy and confidentiality. I'm not saying they don't. Not every matter belongs in the marketplace. If we have an issue here between couples, we go to Matthew 18. What happens first? The man and the man, they have a problem with each other, sit down together first to try and work it out together. They don't go to the court. If they can't work it out, then they call for the elders, and that's done in privacy. But if it goes beyond that, what happens? Then it goes to the court and it's revealed to the people. So there are some situations and some matters that require privacy and confidentiality. But let me tell you, some issues, and maybe most, I don't know, are best disclosed with transparency to remove all suspicions. If somebody doesn't know what's going on in your life, but they know something's going on, if they don't know what it is, at least enough to make sure that there's transparency there, they'll make something up. They'll forge something. So Boaz came to the gate. He didn't pull this, which I believe was a young man, aside in the dark, in a closet. He didn't offer him money. He didn't threaten to disclose something about his private life. He didn't do anything at all to make this happen. He goes to the court. He sits with the elders in front of all of the people. He comes to the gate and he waited for God's hand of providence. And behold, the unnamed obstacle comes to the gate. Now perhaps Boaz knew that this man would travel through that gate each day on his way as part of his everyday passing, like us getting up and going to work. Perhaps this was simply by God's design that Boaz showed up and the guy happened to show up. I don't know which one it is. But Boaz called him over to sit, which the author notes is basically this. He says, "Hey, so-and-so." That's what he says. That's the essence of it. "Hey, so-and-so, come over here and sit down." One commentator noted that a man who would not redeem a family name was not worthy of using his name in the text. And so in all of this, we don't know who the first man in line was by name. He's just given the recognition of being called, "Hey, so-and-so." But he walked over and he sat, and Boaz had gathered 10 elders to sit and to judge. That was probably a quorum for adjudicating a family matter. Not every courtroom decision. There are court cases that only allow or call for 6 jurors. Some call for 12, and for some, a judge is the one who ends up giving the verdict. Sometimes you can sit with a referee, and things can be worked out without even going into court. And I think that might be what's happening here. Some cities had as many as 70 magistrates or 70 elders that would sit in the gate. Now we got 10. So there may have been just all he needed to do was find 10 recognized elders, 10 men of wisdom that were recognized by the city that were allowed by law to adjudicate the matters in the city. And let's note that the 10 elders were called out of nowhere. We have no indication that Boaz went and found 10 guys, filled them in on the problem, and then said, "Hey, why don't you come and sit down and help me out here?" He called them over, and they're sitting down for the first time. They have no knowledge of the issue. There's no indication that any of them have any stake in the verdict, and none need to recuse themselves from the proceedings. They are sitting to hear every word for the first time. Fresh to them. That's the way it's supposed to happen. It's not a Matthew 18. If you come to me and you say, "I'm having troubles with Bob, and here's what it is, and here's what he did to me, and here's what needs to be done," we should say to you, "I'm having problems with Bob." Good enough. Go get Bob. Bring him in here. We'll have a sit down. We'll listen to both of you at the same time. Don't fill my head with what you think is the end of the story and that you're the good guy and he's the bad. Let's figure this out together. Now, to be fair, verse 3 does call them kinsmen, but let's also be fair to say that just about everybody in that town was a kinsman. That was tribal land. They were all related, and this is a tribal sense as a family, not a close sense. None of those guys were Uncle Bob, even though they tend to call each other uncle and aunt. They weren't close. These are not close relatives. They're just those within the tribe that have the authority and the power to judge these issues. They judge them by the tribe, for the tribe. You don't go to Reuben to work out a land deal that's happening with Judah. It's different territory. It's different tribes. They have their own towns, their own judges, and their own way of doing business. Verses 3 through 6 records the essence, but certainly not the whole, of the dialogue that morning. We never get the whole thing. We get as much as God thinks we need. But let's be clear here. Telling the truth does not demand that we display all of our cards before the hand is finished. You don't sit around a poker table and get your five cards and go, whoa! What do you do? Poker face, right? And you might say, I need two cards. If you need three cards, you probably got nothing. That's a dead giveaway, isn't it? And yet, you're still playing the hand and you're still holding your cards pretty tight. Discretion isn't the wisdom to withhold the truth. It's the wisdom to know when to call, not to con. The presentation of Boaz is a skillful and wisely constructed approach. It clarifies the issues at stake. There's land to be bought, belongs to Naomi. Everything is on the up and up. Everything's above board. And it exposes true intentions because the young man is all in when he gets that part of the story. This is like, who was the old commentator used to say, and now the rest of the story. Paul Harvey. And so verses 3 and 4, he presents old so-and-so with a no-brainer. It's what this is. It's a no-brainer. Because Naomi is the principal party, Boaz isn't forced to show his Ruth card yet, at least not yet. He is simply disclosing a family matter to the first rightful participant. And the story is this. Hey, you know, y'all know Naomi. Everybody knows Naomi. She came to town. Everybody said, hey, Naomi's back. The widow who came back from Moab. Well, she's got some land that was Elimelech's before he died, and she wishes to sell it. And so in front of the elders and whatever onlookers happen to be there, he says to old so-and-so, you get first dibs. And if you'd rather not buy it, then I'll buy it. Now, so far, old so-and-so can redeem Naomi, purchase some valuable land that will pay dividends into his coffers for centuries. And she's too old to have children. And so no heir can contend the ownership down the road someplace. And so that is indeed a no-brainer. And even Boaz, who's a wise businessman, wants this deal. I mean, if you've ever been to an auction, especially car auctions, you have to have at least two or three people bidding against each other in order to keep the price going up. So Boaz wants it, and he's let that be known. If you don't want it, I'll take it. And so old so-and-so jumps on it. Absolutely. No hesitation. Then Boaz says, but wait, there's more, and it's not a set against two knives. There is more to this deal. So back the boat up for a minute. Not so fast. Naomi and Ruth are a package deal for the land. You can take one, but then you have to take both, not just her. So now we cue that giant bucket of cold water that pours all over this young man who thought he had the deal of the century. If he takes the deal now, he has to take Ruth, and he has to give every serious attempt to supply Ruth an heir. Do we remember what happened with Judah and Tamar, who spilled a seed on the ground and the Lord killed him for it? So he can't just take Ruth and then give it some sort of half-hearted response. He has to actually diligently seek to supply her with an heir for that land. And if a male child was born, then that child would be the inheritor of the land. And it wouldn't be in the name of old so-and-so. It would be in the name of Elimelech. And Elimelech's family line would continue to hold that land in their name. So he would lose all access to that land. If it took him 10 years to find out about an heir, he would be paying money into that land and producing out of that land, only to find out that it's not his land anymore and everything goes to this new little male child that was born. That cash cow would be suddenly lost. And so all of a sudden his three aces meet a full house and so folds like a cheap accordion. He can afford the investment, but he can't afford the loss. And the matter falls to Boaz in the end. Listen, there are no obstacles to providence, only distractions to faith. You understand that? There are really no obstacles to providence, only distractions to faith. Obstacles are points of interest that we get to observe to see how God will have his way anyway. Obstacles, I think, are just there to allow God to show that he's in charge and not you, and not your neighbor, and not the guy in line in front of you, and not the guy that wants your job, and not the accusation that's been made against you, and not the failure that you did that could cost you your marriage or your job or some other thing. And God is saying, don't pay attention to the obstacles, but look at those so you can see what I'm going to do. Watch me work. They don't hinder me. I put them there. Ruth 3:18, what does Naomi say to Ruth? Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will fall. That is great counsel. You know how many times I've had to say that to somebody, and it seems like a platitude? And it's not. I have to sit and say, we don't know how this is going to end. Let's wait and see. Nobody that's waiting for an end wants to wait and see. They want to know right now. But they only really want to know right now if it turns out the way they want it to. Otherwise, they really don't. They're just anxious to get it over with, but they don't want to hear bad news. Most of the time when you say to somebody that there's good news and bad news, they want to hear the good news first. They want to know whether the good news outweighs the bad news before they have to hear it. Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will fall. Wait. Wait. Wait upon the Lord. Fear assumes an end that's not in evidence. Faith glorifies God and waits to see how it ends. Boaz had a desire that was a good desire. But was it God's desire? Just because we want something and it seems like a really good thing doesn't mean it is a good thing. I'm looking to, talking to somebody this morning. I was talking to Felicia and she was talking about the drug. That drug has some side effects. It has some serious side effects in some ways that some people get. They take precautions. I have to have blood work every 2 weeks for like 18 months to make sure. If it works good, it works really good. Do you know what I don't want? I don't want to have those side effects. How good is that drug if it destroys my liver? What do I want? I want the precautions and the protections, don't I? And I don't want to take anything that's going to make things worse. That's what we do when we choose to go our own way. We want something so bad that we don't care that the actual outcome is worse than the problem that you started out with. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 13 says, consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In other words, you can't fix what God is doing, because first of all, you're not more powerful than him, and second of all, it doesn't need to be fixed. It needs to be followed. Why are you trying to make straight what God's made crooked? Ecclesiastes 3:14, let me read that to you. I know that whatsoever God does, it shall be forever. In other words, when he says that, he doesn't mean that what he does is is going to last forever, but he's saying this. Whatever God does, you can't change it, ever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God does it that men should fear before him. That's why he does it. If God brought Ruth all the way from Moab, 1,800 miles away, years, over decades earlier, setting up this whole scenario, if she belongs to Boaz, then there was no possibility anyone else could have her. That was never a possibility. That guy in first in line, just an obstacle, that Boaz is going to wait and see how God dispensed of him. Or Boaz is going to find out that this wasn't what he thought it was. It's the same way in which God has chosen us before the foundation of the world. Every single person for whom Christ died belongs to him, and not one will be lost. We used to understand that years ago in this country, going all the way back to the Reformation, and really, I mean, as far as our history goes, but going back biblically all the way back, of course, to the apostles. But every single person for whom Christ died belongs to him. We can't talk them into the kingdom. We can't keep them from falling on their face. There's nothing we can do to save those whom Christ has not saved. But every single person for whom he paid the price is coming into the kingdom. God is making sure of that. That's a certainty. We were chosen in him before the foundation of the world. Before the foundation of the world. The church is his bride. Like Ruth is going to be Boaz's bride, and no one else can have her. True believers never fall away from Christ. We die in faith because nobody else may have the bride of Christ. But Christ, but the groom. We're not up for grabs. We're not at risk to be lost. Calvary, however, could not be avoided for that to happen. The very best thing, the thing that our brother has been showing us the thread for from Genesis through, he'll eventually get through the rest of the Bible, probably by the time I'm dead, I'm sure, but still he'll get there. But from Calvary, the very thread that's been sewn through the scriptures has been pointing at a Messiah that everybody wanted to believe was going to come in on a white horse and vanquish Rome and set up his kingdom. And instead, this lowly man comes on the scene. Comely looking man. That means nothing about him. Even the pictures that are artist conception, which that picture of Jesus, by the way, was not drawn by somebody at the scene. That's an artist conception. I think it was an Italian artist who conceived that picture. And in that picture, he's very much a European. He doesn't look anything. There's nothing Jewish about him in that picture. And that picture makes him somewhat attractive, right? But you couldn't pick him out of a crowd. Judas had to go kiss him to pick out which one he was. He didn't stand out. He wasn't that guy that had that charisma that everybody was looking for. And they go, oh, I know which one that is. That's that Jesus guy right there. They had to go, okay, which one of that bunch is he? That guy, that's who came. He goes to Calvary. And on Calvary, he dies. End of the story, right? No, beginning. It began before time. But Calvary was just a part of that thread that was completely tied up when Jesus rose from the grave. Who thought that? Nobody but Jesus. Listen, the life that we live in him is as sure as our redemption. There is not one thing we need to fear if we trust him. Not one thing. Galatians 2:20 says, "The life that I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me." Christ lives in me. Do you believe that? Because I don't think any of us, I'm on that same train, live as though we believe that. When we fear, that's human. When we act on it, that's faithless. It will never get for us what we think it's going to get for us. One of the things with addictions when I'm putting together this class is that from the very first time you take that drug or that alcohol, you get something from it that you think you've gotten that vanishes quickly and creates more problems, and you keep going back to get something that is doing nothing but taking from you. It takes everything from you. It gives you nothing in return. But we can go to the Lord and get everything that we really need. Not all the things we desire that we want to consume in our flesh, but everything we really, really need. Proverbs 4 offers us some great closing counsel. I'm going to read it quickly, and I'm going to just kind of spot through it as we go. Proverbs 4, verses 20 through 27. It says, "My son, attend to my words, incline thine ear unto my sayings." Keep our ears, he's saying, attentive to God's words, not possibilities or lies. Listen to Him. Verse 21, "Let them not depart from your eyes. Keep them in the midst of your heart." Keep His words. Keep them close to your heart so they are core supports to your life. Verse 22, "For they are life unto those that find them and health to all their flesh." They provide both physical and spiritual health. Let me tell you something. Sin and stress and fear and bitterness all bring a lack of health. Do you feel good when those things are in your life? What do you feel like doing? I know what I feel like doing. I feel like going to bed. I feel lousy. I have no energy. I have no drive. I have no desire. Sin eats us up. Bitterness, God's word says bitterness rots the bones. You want to die young? Live a bitter life. And if you don't die young, you'll look like you did anyway. Verse 23, "Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life." Everything that's an issue in our life is a heart issue. It comes from inside of us, not from outside of us. We aren't being attacked by things outside that we can't deal with. Things outside are things we desire inside. Be aware that your heart is the issue. 24, "Put away from you a froward mouth, a pervert and perverse lips. Put far from you." Put away, far away, what is not truthful. A very simple principle. Speak the truth. 25, "Let thine eyes look right on, and let thine eyelids look straight before you. Don't be distracted by the lust of the eyes." Listen, Eve, it says, saw that the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eyes, and she ate from it. That's what she did. 26, "Ponder the path of your feet, and let all thy ways be established. Watch where you walk. Don't stumble, don't fall. It matters where you go. We are not immune to sin. As we get older, most of us will know this. Many of us will know this. You're not as sure-footed as you used to be. You're much more likely if you get running or going somewhere. If I get running, my body is much faster than my feet. And my feet are saying, I'm not keeping up. My body's saying, you're doing just fine. That's where it goes. And it really, really, really hurts. When you go, it really hurts. Look where you're walking. What's that mean? Don't go to places you shouldn't be going. Pay attention to where you're going. 27, "Turn not to the right hand nor to the left. Remove your foot from evil." We tend to walk where we look. You drive in a car sometime, don't try it. You've probably already done this, but you're doing this and you're looking at something down here, and next thing you know, you hear gravel or you hear that rumble strip on the side of the road because that's where you've gone. You're looking over here. It's just what your body does. Saying, keep your eyes straight. Don't look to the left. Don't look to the right. Don't listen. Keep your eyes on the road. Stay on the road. Stay in your lane. We have to have cars now. We're so bad at distraction. We have to have cars that the car puts us back into the lane. The car has to think for us and put us back into the lane. All of these require that we operate in a way that pleases God. His way, with faith, not fear, no lies. It's a wonderful thing when the men came for Jesus in the garden, he stepped forward. He didn't say, hey, when they come for me, don't tell them who I am. They didn't carry passports and identification. They could have said, oh, Jesus, he's not here. He went ahead and what did he do? He walked with them. He went to Calvary. He stood in that courtroom in front of everybody. He was a mockery and a scandal on Calvary for our sake. Because he did what was right. The only thing that was right. We all get eternal life. Let's not disgrace him by taking small things in life and not trusting that he knows what he's doing. It'll end up his way no matter what we do. There's no doubt about that. But we choose our own way, and there's a price to pay for that in that process. You will not come out of that without some bumps and bruises. Don't go there. Go to the court, put it on the line, let God show you what he's going to do. The obstacles, they just declare what he's doing. Amen? All right. Bow our heads. Heavenly Father, Lord God, we thank you.